5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Today on The Grave Talks, Haunted Ohio. Locked in what is known as America's Rust Belt, Ohio is a land that was once rich in industry and progress. Today, many of its once thriving communities are struggling to survive. Declining industry, aging factories, and falling populations have all left a negative impact on this once strong backbone of America. With this rich history and negative decline comes emotions, strong emotions that seem to feed the spirit of generations past. Souls of those who may have left this earth in living form still roam the physical locations they helped to create. The souls that make up Haunted Ohio. On today's episode of The Grave Talks, we talk about many haunted locations throughout Ohio as investigated by John Kashuba.
The first thing is I just do some basic research. You know, I go online and I see, common haunted places, places that a lot of people talk about or have written about or have made some sort of, notoriety, So I'll start with those places because they're pretty well known, but to be honest with you, once I'm there, I just start asking around. I start talking to people because my books are really about interviewing people pretty much all the time. And I get other stories. I'll go to a place that's really well known, like let's say the Ohio State Reformatory in Mansfield. Everybody in Ohio at least knows that place, if not further out than Ohio. So I'll go there and I'll talk to people there, but then I'll just say, I'll be talking to people and I'll say, so, what else is in the Mansfield area? And people say, oh, well, do you know about, Bob's Tavern? I'm just making that name up,
Sure.
I'll say, no, I never heard of it. And they said, oh, yeah, well, we go there all the time and we've heard stories about it. So I'll go over to Bob's and talk to the owners there and everything else and do my own investigation. So what usually happens is I frequently find places that people hadn't written about before, or just, maybe known more locally, like the people in town know it and the town next door maybe, but the rest of the state, people who are interested in the paranormal have never heard of the place. So it's really just, digging, and it's just talking to people, asking questions, because this happens all the time. When I give talks as well, I give library talks frequently on this subject, and I will always have people who will come to me after, the Q&A, and they'll say, well, again, the same thing. Well, how come you didn't write about, the museum across the street, right from the library, And I'll say, what about it? Well, you know, there's two ghosts in there. You're kidding me. You know, so that's how those things happen. I mean, by chance. But my whole emphasis was to try to find places that weren't all that well known.
Mm-hmm.
I had to include the common places, because if I didn't, people will say, well, what kind of researcher are you? You didn't know about the Ohio State Reformatory? Well, yeah, of course I did, you know. But I wanted to put it in. But I also wanted to find places that, well, maybe you haven't heard about that one.
Sure. When you're out there and you're on a haunted road trip and you're covering a lot of ground, how long are you out there just in one trip to try and hit a bunch of places? And how many places can you hit on one, you know, road trip, if you will?
Right. That's sometimes a problem. There was never really one road trip. I mean, I make many road trips because
sure.
You're right. I had other writing responsibilities. You know, I work as a writer, so I couldn't just be away for, you know, a month at a time doing this kind of stuff. I would try to spend as much time in a location as I could. If there were places where I could actually stay, like a haunted hotel, I would definitely make a point of trying to stay there and getting a room and staying overnight and maybe spending like 2 days there or something.
Mm-hmm.
But truthfully, more often than not, I was in a place, you know, maybe for several hours during the course of a day and then out, trying to talk to as many people as I can in that location and more get their stories than anything, because it's pretty unlikely that I'm going to pop in on any given day, spend a couple hours at a place and have all kinds of wonderful experiences. You know, it just doesn't, they don't work on demand, unfortunately, you know? So that was a little bit of a problem. But I feel comfortable enough about it because the people that I spoke to were people that worked there, that were there in and out all the time. And, you know, certainly had a much longer tenure in that location than I did. And so they had stories they've accumulated over days, weeks, months, years, you know. So that's what I did, is we recorded those stories primarily.
What do you think it is about Ohio? Because obviously you have two books on Ohio, and you have several books mm-hmm. about different states and different areas. But Ohio, obviously, a little more attention there. What is it about Ohio that has, in your opinion, more activity, it seems, than some of the others?
Yeah, I get that question all the time, and I really don't have a strong answer for that. Ohio certainly has an interesting history, but, you know, so do most of the places in the United States. We've had our share of disasters and, you know, and frontier life and everything else like so many other states have had. We've had warfare here like so many other states have had. So we're not unique in that regard. But there's other things that I wonder about. For instance, in Athens, Ohio, there are, you've probably heard of ley lines, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a theory that several ley lines cross through Athens, to that area, so that you have sort of a nexus of ley lines coming in from different areas. And people say, well, that creates a lot more energy. It creates, you know, it's a better source for anything in the paranormal because of this energy that's created in these ley lines. Well, I mean, I haven't had a chance to really study that for sure to know whether this is accurate or not. But if it is, it would certainly explain, I think, so many of the stories that come out of Athens and that area, you know, southeast Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of stories that come out of there, and I've written about them. But I wonder also if that might not be true in other areas of Ohio as well.
Sure.
And then there's the geology, too, might play into it, because there's theories about the type of minerals that are in a particular area. Now, we have a lot of, you know, limestone and things like that, and that's supposed to, from what I understand, I don't want to say resonate. That's maybe not the right word. I'm not a geologist. I'm not a physicist. But let's just say contain more energy than maybe some other elements or other geological structures. So there could be something even in the geology of Ohio that contributes to, let's say, the right conditions for a paranormal event.
Sure.
Speculation, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what we do and what we talk about on this topic is speculation. It's opinion based. It's always interesting to get, you know, your take on it, especially if you're out there and you're doing your own form of investigating. With Ohio, I guess my question is, as you get out there and you get into the field, or really any place, doesn't just have to be Ohio. Let's say you find a lot of information, a lot of stories about a specific location. And let's say it's a private location. It's not just, you know, the battlefield over here that anyone could easily talk about, but it's a residence or it's a hotel or something. But there's a lot of information out there about it, and a lot of people have stories and opinions in about it. But then you reach out to the person who owns the place and you say, hey, right. I'd love to talk to you about this. And they're like, we want nothing to do with it. Or you just get, or you get the dial tone immediately. How do you handle something like that when that occurs?
It's happened. Yeah. I mean, I can recall a place that I actually investigated in Illinois. It was like a spa. It was in an old home, but it was like a spa and day, you know, like a day salon and spa and all that kind of stuff. And I had heard that it was haunted. And I went up there and I rang a doorbell and I talked to the person that owned it. And she said, okay. She wasn't jumping up and down about, oh, great, you're here. But she said, okay, you know, take a look around and see what you do. So I walked around a little bit, but I wasn't there more than maybe 20 minutes or so before she approached me. And she said, you know, I'm having second thoughts about this. I don't really think I want this stuff out there. Uh-huh. When that happens, I mean, I respect their wishes. You know, it was a private business. The owner was saying that they didn't want the story to be out. So I let it go. And there's been other places like that too, where I've approached, not so much private places, because the nature of my books were that I always wrote about places that the public could access. I didn't write about somebody's home, you know, or their private property or something, because I wanted people to actually be able to go on their own and experience these things. And I knew that would be difficult for private locations. But I did find I found some myself that I was interested in just finding out more about, and did have people like this woman in Illinois, who, even though she was running a business, which is open to the public, just didn't want that out there. So, I had started to get some interesting stories from her and everything, but that was it. She said, well, I don't want it. And I said, well, okay. I mean, there's so many other stories out there that, you know, if I lose one or two because the people don't want to talk about it or don't want it out there, I'm really not losing anything.
Sure. I just know sometimes we get that where you get these leads. It's like, oh, that's a great story. I'd love to learn more. Then you get to the point of like, okay, let's tell it. And then so there's a roadblock. And I know sometimes there's ways of making it generic and not stating here's the actual location, but it's a place like this in this general state.
I can give you a real quick example, because just about a month and a half ago, one of my publishers released a paranormal novel that I wrote called Dark Entry. Mm-hmm. And this place is based on an actual location in Connecticut where I grew up. It was called Dudley Town, was how most people referred to it. And you can just go on a Google search of Dudley Town. You'll get all kinds of stuff on it. But the short story is that it's private property now. It's several homes up on a mountain, and it's a private preserve that they own, and they don't want trespassers there or anything else. And they even basically sent me a letter and told me that I'm not allowed to speak about Dark Entry in public. I'm not allowed to write about it. Well, okay, I have First Amendment rights. Now, you can't tell me that. I won't go on your property, but you can't tell me that I can't write about it if it's, you know, if I want to. Mm-hmm. And because of their tone, I said, you know, I'm writing this novel. But what I did was, the novel is a novel, so it's fiction. So it's loosely based on events that supposedly happened there at that location. Mm-hmm. So that's another way of getting around it. It's not 100% accurate, in the sense that I'm telling stories that I've embellished, obviously, and elaborated upon, because it's a novel and it's fiction. But the basics of, you know, the location, some of the things that were supposed to have happened, I mean, they're in that novel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I got the last laugh on them, I guess.
Sure. I just, one of those curious logistics I know that sometimes our audience has on how, you know, we do what we do. So I thought you're a great source to answer that question with your books. Let's start talking about some of the things in Ohio in some more depth. Let's start talking about some locations, some places. And let's start out with the Toledo area. That always struck me as a very interesting part of the country. The first time I ever went to Toledo, I was 17, and I had a friend who was working in radio there who had moved, And I did a sneaky road trip. I told my parents I was going to visit my girlfriend's grandparents over the holidays, and me and another friend road tripped to Toledo just to visit our friend. And it was a great time. I got in a lot of trouble, but it was a great time. I remember going through that city. And, you know, obviously it's a very industrial town. It's a town that in a lot of ways, I would say at this time, which was about 1999-ish, it seemed it was on some hard times. I don't know exactly what the state of it is today. But it really, there was a vibe there. There was kind of an oddness to it. I don't know how to put it in any other way. And I'm not trying to insult Toledo or anything of that nature, but that's just kind of how I felt. It was a very cold, foggy, you know, rainy winter day when I was there. Right. But we stayed at a downtown hotel, and I remember there was a pool on the rooftop of the hotel, all enclosed. Went up there, no water in the pool, but you could easily go and sit by it. There was just weirdness that I was feeling the whole time. The whole time I was in Toledo. So I'm imagining there's probably a good deal of stories around the area. Would you mind sharing some of those for us?
Yeah, well, there's two places that I wrote about in Toledo in particular that I think are interesting, and one was it's called the Collingwood Art Center. And Collingwood is an old section of Toledo that at one time was very posh. You know, it was all these old Victorian homes, and the people who had money in Toledo lived there. Mid-late 19th century. Well, that's changed now. It's like every other city. It's not so much there anymore.
Sure.
But Collingwood Arts Center is great. It started off as a college, a Catholic college called Marymount's. Staffed by Ursuline nuns. And by the time I had heard about it, it had long passed from being a college. It fell into disrepair for almost 20 years. It was vacant, and it was an eyesore, and you had homeless people in there, and you had drug users, and, you know, all kinds of damage. It was just miserable. The city of Toledo, I guess, at that point, had it. And I guess it fell into receivership or something. But an arts corporation, a nonprofit in Toledo, approached the city and said, "We'll take this off your hands for you if you like. Give it to us for a dollar, and we will totally renovate it ourselves, all at our own cost. And not only that, but we'll move in. We'll live there. We'll have, you know, music studios, paint studios, sculpture, you know, all that kind of stuff. The place had a theater because it was, you know, like I said, it was a college. It had a little stage and everything. They said, we'll have neighborhood theater and all that kind of stuff. Well, they were true to their word. They did that. The place is great now. It's a cultural center. It's an art center. But when I went up there, I had heard that people were having some strange experiences up there. I had heard from a friend of mine who went up there for some kind of a public event. And so I went up there, and I checked it out myself. And I basically started on my own, working in the basement. Just, this place was huge. It's a very, very large facility. And so the basement wasn't just one square room, but it was a hallway with several rooms off it that the nuns in the old days used to have, like, their infirmary down there, their bakery was down there, so all this stuff. And when I went there, it was just, the basement was a wreck. It was just dirty and dusty and piled up with junk and everything, and half lit, you know, most of the light bulbs were out. And so I'm walking down there, and by myself, and as I'm walking down, all of a sudden I get to an area that's a little bit darker. There was no light there, and I felt the air around me, sort of the atmosphere, suddenly felt very, very heavy, very dense. It's almost like somebody, like, threw a wet blanket over me. I mean, it was such a sudden, instantaneous change that literally stopped me in my tracks. You know, I said, "What is that?" And at the same time that I felt this atmospheric change, I got an overwhelming sense of depression. Like, sadness and depression, it hit me just like that. And that's not my usual nature. And all that, I couldn't understand it. So I just kept walking. And with, like, another, you know, 3 or 4 feet, everything lifted as suddenly as it came. I mean, instantaneously. You know, the air felt fine. The depression was gone. And I just kept saying, what the heck was, you know, what did I walk through? What was that? So I went upstairs, and I was talking to some of the artists who live there, and I was asking what their experiences were and everything. And one of the things they talked about, they had a gamut of you know, doors opening and closing and hearing footsteps, sort of the traditional smorgasbord of hauntings, you know.
Sure.
They had all that. But they talked about something that they used to see in the basement. And they defined it as being a life-size figure, but all black, like a black silhouette. If you can imagine taking construction paper and just cutting out a life-size, you know, figure out of black construction paper, no detail, just black. That's what they saw. And, you know, they saw this thing in the basement, and they called it Shadow Man. That's what they're, you know, that was their name for it. They said, "Oh, Shadow Man." So I got one of the guys, and I said, "All right, let's go back down the basement. I want you to show me, you know, where you're seeing this thing." Well, you might be ahead of me in my story already, but one of the locations in the basement where they said they've seen this thing was that section that I had walked through.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, well, you know, I mean, I didn't see anything, but did I walk through Shadow Man? Did I experience it? You know, I don't know. But they were seeing this thing all the time. And there was an interesting postscript to the story. 2 weeks after I was there, the art director, the guy who was running this whole facility, called me. And he said, "You might be interested to know that we had some visitors come through, three elderly women who identified themselves as retired Ursuline nuns that used to teach there when it was a college. Now, they heard about how this place had now taken on a new life, and they really loved that building and everything, so they wanted to see it, and he took them on a little tour. Now, they hadn't been in that building in about 20 years. And this whole thing about Shadow Man, nobody had written about it. It wasn't in the newspaper or anything else like that. I was the first person to write about it. So they're walking through the, you know, the facility, and they're so happy to see that it's taking on new life again. The director says to me, just as they were about to leave, I'm leading them out to the door, and just about to ready to say goodbye, one of the nuns turns around. She says, "By the way," she said, "is the shadow still in the basement?" And the guy just said, "What?" Because, you know, he didn't say anything to them about it.
Sure.
Now, so here's the thing. They were there about 20 years previously. Right, and they were experiencing. They talked and they said, "Well, we were seeing the same thing down there." So they were seeing it 20 years ago. You have the artists 20 years later who are saying they're seeing it. And when you talk to both groups individually, they're describing it in the same way, the same location, all that kind of stuff. And these are two groups that didn't have a chance to get together and, you know, corroborate their story or anything else like that, right? And one is nuns. I mean, you know, nuns are supposed to tell you the truth. They're not supposed to lie, right?
Yeah.
So when you get something like that, you know, you can't prove that ghosts exist. But when I get two groups like that, two disparate groups over a 20-year span that say they're witnessing the same thing, I pay attention to that. There's something going on there, you know?
Yeah.
So that place is very cool.
You obviously
open to the public.
You can't prove that ghosts exist, but you can prove that these two groups of people had nothing to do with each other, and they somehow have the same story. That's the part where that in itself is extremely odd and paranormal to a certain sense of just how did they both know this? I mean, that you know, unless they had the same unexplained experience in that location. That's a spooky.
It's like what the police look for, right? When there's a crime,
yeah.
They want to have a couple of different witnesses that can all see the exact same thing without without having gotten together to make a story up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or a reputable media outlet going, "We're not going to confirm this story until we have a couple independent sources saying this is what's happening." It's the same sort of thing. But unfortunately, when it comes to ghosts, all bets are off no matter what. It's never confirmed.
That's right.
Let's talk about some of the other locations here, some that stood out to me in the first book. And a location that I've always, not specifically this location, but more so the concept of the location, libraries. The county district library, is it in, I'm going to say the name of the city wrong, Ashtabula, is that right?
Ashtabula.
Looks like just the image of a perfect old library, giant pillars. it's a building, if you lived in the town, you'd walk by and go, "That's haunted," even if it's not. Just by the look and the feel of it. And I've always had a fascination with libraries, and I always feel like there's some sort of energy there. I don't know. And we've had listeners even say that, too. It's because of the books. It's because of the learning. It's because of all of the feelings that are within there. I didn't have much that happened in my own library as a child other than the elevator would open on its own, which may have just been a bad elevator. But let's hear about the Ashtabula, the library there and what happens.
Yeah, well, there's not a whole big story there. I don't have the name in front of me, unfortunately, but there was a librarian, an elderly, you know, the quintessential elderly female librarian who had been the head librarian for years, you know.
Sure.
And she was there. And the story is that she is still there. I mean, they have, you know, books supposedly move on their own, and some people have heard her voice and things like that. But there were not great stories there, unfortunately, but they definitely feel that there is a presence there. And they feel it's this woman. Her portrait is still there. Now, when you go in and you look at this portrait, now, of course, I didn't know the woman. She's long gone. But she does look like one of these Stern librarians that would definitely tell you to be quiet. You're in a library, you know?
Sure.
Now, I don't know if she was or not. But apparently they say that she's still there. But the stories have been light. There hasn't been any... what would I say, like major events there, unfortunately, as much as just, you know, the typical hearing things, hearing her voice, they say, and then also just having books move around on their own and all, which that's so every library that I know has a haunted ghost that is haunted has that phenomena of the books, you know, coming off shelves one by one or restacking themselves, all those kinds of things, which I find interesting. But the thing about Ashtabula was that there was a famous train wreck that occurred there, not far from the library, in fact. And I don't know the exact year on that. It was 19th century, but a train went right off a railroad bridge into the river, and this was in the middle of the winter. And hundreds of people died. And it was not only did they die, but the aftermath was even horrible because you had people come in from the town that scavenged the bodies, you know, and stole jewelry and money off them and everything else. It was awful. But when the bodies were recovered, they were brought up there. Now, it's possible they could have been brought to the library because it's very close to the scene of the disaster, too. So there might be something connected to that as well. I don't know.
When you have visited haunted libraries, and this can be more of a broad-based question of, it doesn't have to be in Ohio, just libraries in general, and you've stepped in them, do they tend to be more calm in nature in terms of haunting activity versus a more dramatic, or does it really depend on the library?
Well, I would say the ones that I've investigated have been what you would call calm. They've been relatively minor things, and it is the things like I'll give you an example: the Peoria Public Library in Illinois. In fact, I just did a radio interview with a guy from the American Library Association about the Peoria Library just a couple weeks ago because it's haunted, and I know that one of the librarian workers there was down in the basement, and she said she was working down there, and a book fell off the shelf. And so, okay, she went, she put it back up, then it fell off again. But then one by one, every book after it just fell off the shelf. You know, they were just like literally throw themselves off the shelf, which is, you know, kind of a calm event, I suppose. But if you happen to witness it, you might not, you know, feel so calm. But those are the kinds of things that I hear from libraries, is that kind of stuff. Or sometimes they'll talk about a patron being there. For instance, at the Peoria Public Library, and not actually a patron, but one of the former library directors, people have seen an apparition of one of the library directors. Now, three of them, over the course of the library's history, three of the library directors actually died in the library, one from a heart attack, one from being hit by a streetcar right in the sidewalk in front, and I forgot what the other one did, suicide, I think. But so people have said, well, you know, they've seen a director there. So that's kind of an unusual situation because I'm not aware of other libraries that's had that kind of a death toll. But, you know, sometimes I know there's another library, I can't remember where it was, who talked about an old guy that used to be a patron. Like he'd come to the library all the time, you know, he'd spend hours there and just, you know, it's kind of a socialization for him as well as a place to go or whatever. And that when he passed away, that, you know, people have said, well, you know, they have seen him back there again. So, yeah. But I would think relatively calm compared to certainly compared to what you might find on a battlefield or something like that, I would imagine.
Sure. Calm, but I'd say evident, where you have things that are happening in front of you. Maybe not a full-bodied apparition that's going to fly up and make you all run out, Ghostbusters-esque, but when books are falling where they shouldn't be, it can be startling unto itself. Let's talk about, pick out some of the I know there's a lot of restaurants, obviously public locations that you talk about in some in your books in Ohio. What are some of those that stand out to you as being some of the more, I guess we could use the word, dramatic hauntings that are out there?
Yeah, I think for restaurants, I think one that I like is the Amber Rose restaurant in Dayton, Ohio, which is kind of an Eastern European restaurant. And there was a, it was owned by a family. It started back again late, maybe late 1890s, maybe early 1900s. And I have so many names in my books I can't remember. I do not have the name of the family at my fingertips at this moment. Sure. But I do remember that it was a family restaurant that was started, and, you know, gradually the members got old and passed away, and it fell into the hands of one of the daughters, whose first name was Chicky. I remember that was her nickname, was Chicky. And she had a very Polish last name, which I do not remember. But, you know, everybody loved Chicky, and she was the last family member to be in the restaurant. And, you know, she took care of it. She loved the family business. She tried to maintain it right up until her death. And today, it's still a restaurant, no longer in that family. But they say that Chicky is still there, and there's a lot of stories that have come out of that. Some are typical things that you hear, just as you hear some typical library stories. There's some typical restaurant stories, and they're very simple things. It's like a server coming in and setting up tables with place settings, you know, empty tables and setting it all up, and then going into the kitchen or something, then coming back to find that the place settings are all messed up. They're all out of order, and she has to reset it, you know, or putting glasses down on a table and then coming back into the room and finding the glasses somewhere else. This seems to be common, and that happens at the Amber Rose. But one thing that happened that's kind of interesting is they have a bunch of ceramic plates, you know, painted, decorated plates that hang on the wall. I don't know how many, but there's several. And they came into the restaurant one morning and found that all the plates were still hanging on the wall, but they were all turned around. They were reversed, so you're looking at the back of the plates instead of all the paintings. Now, you know, I don't know who would have done that. A chef talked about working in the kitchen one night, and he was, I'm not sure if he was cleaning up or whatever he's doing, but he was by himself at the time. He was working in the kitchen. And he said that he felt sort of, he had like a weird sensation. And he turned around and he said there was a ball of light. He described it as a blue ball of light that was like right in the room, like right with him. And it was, you know, large, like at least the size of maybe a softball, if not larger. And he said it was there and just glowed, and then it just disappeared. You know, he obviously didn't know what that was. So this place is interesting. There's different things going on, and as I say, they attribute them all to the spirit of Chicky, who they say is still there. And again, like I hear so often in some of these types of hauntings, they're not, the people who work there now aren't, they're not afraid of them. They take it as a warm feeling in a way. They say, well, you know, Chicky is still here. She's letting us know she's here, and she's looking over us and looking over the restaurant and all that, which is okay, you know. But those things happen at that place, and they will talk about it to you, you know, when you go there. That's, again, the places that I write about, the people that I write about at these locations are certainly agreeable to tell you their stories and, you know, show you around or whatever.
That wraps up part one of our interview with John Kashuba about haunted Ohio. In part two of our interview, there are many battlefields in Ohio. Many are the final resting spots for soldiers of another time. Who are they, and why do they still haunt the ground where they perished? Also, what happened at a theater that once was the site of soldiers' bodies being stacked ground to ceiling? What are some of the most haunted cemeteries in Ohio? And haunted Ohio hotels? What are some of the most active locations, and who is haunting them? Also, what are some of the least likely places to find a ghost in Ohio? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food. And before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1. Download Rocket Money. Step 2. Link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3. Create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step 1. Download Rocket Money. Step 2. Link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step 3. Tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4. Create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.